The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now, you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce, or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams, or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
Clean, safe, local. Your home for business is the Village of Bedford Park. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Thursday afternoon, December 5th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. Private employment numbers are out, along with jobless claims ahead of tomorrow's government jobs report for November. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, Bitcoin has passed $100,000 per token for the first time as President-elect Trump selects a pro-crypto SEC chair. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Bill Ulysses Very, owner of Senecal Capital Management in Glenview, the website senecalcapital.com. Bill, thank you for joining us today. With Bitcoin passing the $100,000 per token threshold, what does this mean for the cryptocurrency space, which has seen a lot of swings in valuation over the past couple of years?
Well, Rob, people buying cryptocurrency today, it's as chaotic as a Black Friday TV sale at Walmart. I mean, it has been insane. The volatility, the increases, the percentage year-to-date of gains. And I'm smiling as I'm having this conversation with you because it was exactly 2 years ago today on December 5th where Andy Gershaw and I did one of his gains podcasts, and we predicted Bitcoin would go to about $1 million a token. And that was back when it was 18. So what we're seeing now with the Trump administration getting a pro crypto SEC chairman. We have Fed Chairman Jerome Powell commented that Bitcoin is like digital gold. President Trump met with Brad Garlinghouse, who was the CEO of XRP Ripple Labs. XRP, if you know, is like the banking SWIFT token that transfers money from one part of the globe to the other in a matter of seconds. We have Michael Saylor just going on and on and on about his Bitcoin strategy. And it's the greatest performing stock that we know this year, of up 543%. MicroStrategy stock is just off the chain.
Now, if it had, no pun intended, off the blockchain, as it were.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency are here to stay, and we do have an incoming SEC chairman who may have a lighter touch when it comes to crypto regulation. But what is a lighter regulatory environment? What does that mean for the viability of crypto going forward? Because you do need rules to make the marketplace work.
Absolutely. We need rules, but you don't need founders punished without a rule book to follow. And in many of the lawsuits and in the billions of dollars that have been spent to defend small startup technology companies against the SEC and against regulators being debanked because they were in a cryptocurrency business, I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have rules and regulations. I'm just saying that we should not have a aggressive, vindictive regulatory framework that sues people without actually being able to answer a question on what rules they should be following. I mean, it's just not the American way. So with the SEC chairman coming out, we should have a clear rule book, a clear map of a friendly partnership between technology startups, blockchain, and future technology, whatever AI, whatever's ahead of us, and the SEC without being, completely on the opposite side of the of the legal bench, so to speak, right? And we're seeing it in banking with Operation Choke Point 2.0. I mean, you just do some research and you can see that these poor technology companies were just getting crushed by the SEC and other regulatory bodies, moving their businesses over offshore. And hopefully this new change in pro-blockchain technology by this administration will hopefully allow our nation to recapture the lead it had in artificial intelligence and blockchain technology.
Bill Ulivieri, owner of Senecal Capital Management in Glenview, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, a review of key data ahead of tomorrow's government jobs report.
An economy of words. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The private sector added 146,000 jobs last month, short of most analysts' expectations. This all comes ahead of tomorrow's government employment report for November. We welcome in Paul Christopher, head of Global Investment Strategy at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute in St. Louis. Paul, thank you for joining us today. That 146,000 job figure comes from the ADP, the private payroll processing report that comes out the Wednesday before the Friday government jobs report. Now, last month's government jobs report was kind of light, the figure for October, and we could see that could also impact the November report as well coming out tomorrow.
Yeah, we don't really know, Rob, how much that big grain of salt we needed last month because of the hurricanes, you know, going back to September, August, even October. We don't know how much those storms impacted the employment report, and there may be still some carryover. But markets are expecting a more normal employment report tomorrow, something around the order of 200,000 jobs created, and that's about in line with the long-term average. So you can see that the labor market has cooled and has normalized since COVID.
Yeah, that's really the trend here, that maybe job growth has kind of returned to where it was in 2019, and you're no longer seeing those 500,000, 700,000, 1 million figures that we saw coming out of the depths of the COVID-19 shutdowns.
Yeah, that's right. And even if we should see a big revision to the past, to the previous month, again, that just reflects the difficulty of counting people when you have so many dislocations because of those storms a few months ago. So, yes, you're right. The Fed will be watching these numbers very carefully. We think you'd have to see a number much higher than about 250,000 jobs gained in order for the Fed to hold off on a quarter point rate cut by December 18th. We're expecting that quarter point rate cut will probably be in the works.
How can we assess the job market right now? We talked about maybe it's normalized back to its pre-pandemic levels, snapped back to where it was in 2019. But it seems like it paints a picture of a job market where companies don't want to let go of talent. There's not a wave of layoffs. That's not showing up in the Thursday jobless reports. But at the same time, maybe they're not adding talent as prodigiously as they did several years ago. So if you are looking for a job, how do you assess your chances?
Yeah, well, there's still pretty much one opening for every person looking for a job. Now, whether that particular opening or any series of openings, collection of openings, suits that particular individual, that's another question. But there's not really a shortage of jobs. That's more normal than what we're used to seeing. But at the same time, yeah, employers might be reluctant to let people go here because the economy has been slowing, but a lot of people are expecting it to pick up, including consumers. And you'll see some consumer sentiment data tomorrow that indicate consumers are strengthening their expectations for the next 6 months. So you probably don't want to lay a lot of people off here.
Paul Christopher, head of Global Investment Strategy at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute in St. Louis. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, help in deciding if this is a good time to invest in an electric vehicle.
Conversation that's on the money. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
If you're in the market for an electric vehicle, now may be the perfect time to buy one. Joining us to explain is Jeff Gilbert, CBS News automotive reporter based in Detroit, Michigan. Jeff, thanks for joining us today. And there's lots of questions surrounding the EV space. A number of automakers are paring back some of their ambitious plans for EV production, and there's a possibility that some of the EV tax credits could be targets of the incoming Trump administration. So if you want to purchase an EV right now, what is the state of the marketplace?
Well, state of the marketplace is there are a lot of vehicles out there, and many of them have been sitting on dealer lots for a while. You've got a lot of new products in the marketplace, like a new Chevy Equinox electric vehicle, a couple of new electric pickups. The startups are out there like Rivian and Tesla as well, and there are a number of deals because it's not like it was a couple of years ago when there was a lack of EVs on the market.
Now, are these deals that would make EVs affordable compared to where EVs were priced several years ago, or does this make EVs affordable with respect to other internal combustion engine cars?
Well, if you throw in the tax credit, it certainly would. And that, of course, is a big variable here. Even as it stands right now with the tax credit in place, it's not on every vehicle because some of them have foreign content. And it's not for every buyer because there are certain income rules. So there are a lot of rules there. But if you can get one, it does put it in competition with a gasoline-powered vehicle. And there are actually a couple of deals out there. I've seen some lease deals out there that look even better than some gasoline-powered vehicles.
And as you point out in your own EV experience, that it's not just the amount of money you pay to get that EV off the lot. Because it is a different engine, you could save on maintenance over the life of your EV experience. And even though your electric bill goes up installing the EV charger, over the course of a year, you save potentially thousands of dollars not filling it up at the gas station.
Yes, referred to total cost of ownership. And EVs do tend to have less maintenance. And, you know, charging with electricity while you're still paying for something does tend to cost less than filling up with gasoline. Of course, it depends on the individual. And you still have those issues about range anxiety, things of that nature. But for somebody who has a garage, can't afford the extra money to put in a level 2 charger, and does a lot of in-city driving, it could be a good proposition.
Now, I was going to say, when it comes to electric vehicles, you know that I have three little ones at home. So what EV options exist in the grocery getter space?
Some of the Kia and Hyundai EVs are very nice. They've got some nice midsize. Even, you know, we're seeing more three-row electric vehicles hit the market. You've got the Kia EV9, which is very nice, and Hyundai has an Ioniq 9 that's coming out. So we're seeing bigger vehicles for people like you with bigger families.
Jeff Gilbert, CBS News automotive correspondent in Detroit, thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, strategies to keep pictures of your kids off of social media.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. A blast of cold is activating warming centers in Chicago. Investigators process evidence in the murder of a healthcare CEO in New York. It's Technology Thursday, reasons you may choose to keep images of your children away from social media. During this holiday season, pet owners can be increasingly targeted by scammers. WBBM Business, the markets are lower now. The Dow is down 181 points. The NASDAQ is down 17. The S&P 500 is down 5. We have 24 degrees right now at O'Hare under mostly sunny skies, but a wind chill of 10. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. It is the weather. Dangerously cold temperatures are prompting the city of Chicago to open warming centers. In addition, health leaders are reminding people to make sure homes and vehicles are prepared for winter conditions. They're also encouraging you to check in on elderly relatives and neighbors and other people who may be at risk in the cold. The search continues for the killer of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, shot to death yesterday in New York City, Midtown Manhattan. He was on his way to an investors' conference when he was gunned down. More from CBS's Meg Oliver.
Police say the suspect pictured at a Starbucks just prior to the shooting appears to be a light-skinned male who was proficient in firearms and wore a hood, mask, and distinctive gray backpack.
The words deny, defend, and depose are written on shell casings found at the scene. Investigators are also processing potential clues gathered from a Starbucks near the scene of the shooting. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets have turned lower. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Art Hogan, chief market strategist with B. Riley Financial based in New York. Art, thank you for joining us today. And I just noticed the markets have indeed ticked lower. Anything to explain that, or is that just part of the ebb and flow of the typical trading day?
Yeah, I think it's very much the ebb and flow of the trading day, and certainly a week that has delivered record highs for all three of the indices on any given day. So I think that a bit of back and forth here is probably making a bit of sense. And I think some of that has to do with the wait and see mode that we're in, with the big jobs number coming out tomorrow, which may well inform us as to what the next move by the Fed is at their December 18th meeting. So I think this is a bit of wait and see. I don't know that there's any massive catalysts that are negative, except for the fact that most of the economic data this week has been stronger. And it looks as though there's no weakness in the labor market. We'll learn more about that tomorrow.
Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said yesterday the economy is strong enough for the Fed to move carefully on rate cuts. And he also said things have improved since that first rate cut of half a percentage point a couple of months ago.
Yeah, certainly have. When we look back at the move in September, we had a weak jobs report in the month of August and in the month of September, and I think that was one of the drivers. The concern that perhaps that strong labor market was rolling over a bit, well, lo and behold, after a weak October report, which was riddled with a couple of hurricanes and a big Boeing strike, we now seem to have the inputs on labor that things have firmed up here. Whether you look at this week's JOLTS report, which firmed up, or the weekly jobless claims, or the ADP report that we got, and then tomorrow's non-farm payroll number. I think if we're going to get back into that sort of 150 to 200,000 jobs being created on a monthly basis, the Fed can certainly take their time with rate cuts, and likely will start taking their time next year, where they've penciled in four rate cuts with eight meetings, so that they may start shifting into an every other meeting type cadence.
But does this mean that if there is an especially strong jobs report tomorrow, maybe over that 200,000 figure, that the December rate cut is off the table? Or is that a situation where it's been telegraphed so much, you can't do that because it would spook the markets more than just following through on your plan?
Yeah, I think the latter part of your question hits it right on the head. I think that the Fed speak this week, and there's been a whole parade of Fed speakers, has certainly been more dovish than not. So, you know, to your point, does the Fed want to take the December meeting off and push their next rate cut into next year? Or do they go ahead as planned and very much in consensus and cut one more time at 25 basis points and then readjust in 2025? We'll get a chance when they deliver their summary of economic projections and dot plots to see what their plans are for 25. And they may well have taken one of those four rate cuts off the calendar for next year. So I think that's their chance to adjust. I don't think it's at this point in the game, they're likely going to move ahead and cut rates. That's about a 75% chance of that happening in the Fed funds futures right now.
Up to this point, I always got the sense that if you were really into Bitcoin and you were a trader, it was kind of a hobby. It was, you got to watch a market emerge. You got to see asset bubbles and troughs, and you learned how to buy the rumor, sell the news, things like that. But now, with Bitcoin over $100,000, zooming up from $17,000 per token just 2 years ago, and a SEC chairman coming in who will probably have a lighter touch when it comes to regulation of the cryptocurrency space. How do you assess this, though, as far as overall market dynamics are concerned? Because when you have things like cryptocurrency and meme stocks hitting all-time highs, that's usually an indication there's a lot of froth in the market. But can you say that's the case this time with crypto going over 100,000?
Yeah, so much to unpack with that. And I like the fact that you went back a couple of years. In those 2 years, if you were to stick it out, you had to go through four drawdowns that were over 50%, and multiple drawdowns that were between 20 and 30%. So it's a very volatile asset class for sure. I think the acceptance of it this year has been driven as much by the fact that there's easy access with ETFs, and then certainly an administration that seems to be pro-crypto coming in next year. So I think there's a combination of things. The early run-up in the beginning of this year was really because you didn't have to go get a wallet or find cold storage. You could actually buy an ETF, and the ease of access was much smoother. So I think we have a combination of things that have driven that up. But to your larger question, I still think that I'd separate the crypto enthusiast from the meme stock enthusiast. I think that's a speculative edge of the market that always seems to come back, raise its ugly head whenever we have a risk-on type attitude in markets, and it tends to fade away when things stabilize a bit. So I would separate those two if you're thinking about speculative assets.
Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist with B. Riley Financial in New York, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, asking people not to post pictures of your kids on social media.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday. Most parents know the dangers of sharing kids' pictures on social media, but how can they politely ask friends and family to also respect their child's privacy? Let's get some advice from Shelley Palmer, CEO of the Palmer Group, Professor of Advanced Media in residence at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Shelley, thank you for joining us today. I think as parents, we know the rules of the road when it comes to posting pictures of our kids on social media. At least most of us do, those of us who aren't Facebook and Instagram oversharers. But what happens if, let's say, your kids are at a birthday party and then the parents of the child being celebrated decide to put pictures of your kids from that party and they didn't ask you? What do you do?
Well, the point is they never ask, and it's gotten to really become a sticking point. What I think the first line of defense is that you ensure that the parents don't tag your kids. Then at least you have one line of defense. Without your child being tagged, it's hard to identify them, or impossible, to be fair. I think a lot of parents that I'm aware of now, and so many have reached out to me to say that they just literally call the parents and say, take this down, or message the parents and say, take this down. You don't have my permission to have my kid there. And I think what there's a new behavior, which I've recently heard of, in fact, with my granddaughter's birthday party. She went, I have four granddaughters. The four-year-old was invited to a birthday party. The parents were, of this child said flat out that if you don't want your kid in social media, then let us know. And about half the children that went to this party opted out of social media. They literally had to separate how they took the pictures. It was really interesting because they didn't want to make the little kids feel bad, right? These 4-year-olds, you know, okay, you can't be in this picture. Why? Your mommy says you can't. It's like, wow, that's problematic. So look, this becomes a real nightmare for parents of young children, and a little less of a nightmare for parents of older children where the kids can opt out themselves. Society has to deal with this. We have to deal with it. You know, it's not easy in any way.
And I think what are some of the your data, personal privacy issues that come up if you post pictures of your kids or somebody else posts pictures of your kids? I mean, there's the obvious stranger danger issues. There's the identity theft issues. But should you also be concerned about social media companies using those pictures to train an AI model? I mean, what are some of the implications when it comes to AI?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Rob. That's probably the least of your worries. When AI trains on face recognition, it's not looking to train on you. It's very different when a data company goes out, finds your pictures, and trains face recognition to be used for law enforcement or to be used for identification with the TSA or, you know, that kind of identification is very scary. But it is absolutely unlikely. In fact, I can tell you it's not happening where a big social media company, where Meta or any of the others for that matter, are going to train on who you are and then sell that to someone. One of the good things Facebook does is it's got a recognition software feature built into it that helps you categorize your photos. And, you know, that's actually very convenient. So I don't think anyone should opt out of that for fear that their images are going to be used in other ways, because they really aren't. And if you've ever tried to sort through your photos or search a photo, you know what a blessing it truly is to have Facebook be able to surface all the photos of Aunt Edna. I mean, especially when it's her birthday and you need a picture of you and Aunt Edna. So, you know, that's not something for people to worry about. When the TSA takes your picture, you should be asking them what they're using it for, because it's really for your identification. So, I mean, that's not a social media issue, and we really shouldn't conflate the two. And with respect to training for AI, generally, you can opt in or opt out at any time by going to the privacy settings and saying you don't want any of your stuff used for AI training. Meta is good about that. So actually is X. So they're all good about it.
Shelley Palmer, CEO of the Palmer Group, professor of advanced media in residence at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, a look at the rise of pet scams.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Pet scams surge during the holidays with an overwhelming number of online ads being potentially fake. We welcome in Steve Burness, president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Chicago. Steve, thank you for joining us today. 10,000 complaints about pet scams, according to a recent BBB investigation filed across the country. What is a typical pet scam that ensnares people, especially around the holidays?
Well, obviously, yeah, everybody's interested in getting a pet for their child or their loved ones, and they want it now. So they go, the first place they tend to go is the internet for everything now. And they see these adorable pets that you can't pass up. They look so great, and it's a lower price than you can get it anywhere else. So you kind of fall for that bait that they have these puppies. They got these great pictures, and only in essence, they don't have any puppies. They're really interested in getting money from you, and then they continue to get money. So you give them a deposit, then they'll call you up a week later or a couple days later and say, well, the puppy's sick. We need veterinarian fees, or we need additional insurance or shipping costs. They keep going until you realize you've been scammed, and that's when you realize you've been duped, and you kind of lean on us to help them out.
And like most scammers, are they asking for this incredibly low, you wouldn't believe it payment via untraceable cash apps?
Usually it's cash apps or wiring money, and that's usually what we call the tip-off to the rip-off. If they want to stay away from normal, typical credit cards, then you have to be worried about it, because those cash apps, you don't have the same protection afforded to you as you do on a credit card, so consumers should be wary of that. But the one number one tip is they don't want to meet you. They can't meet you for some reason. They can't show a picture of you or the puppy itself. And by that, when that happens, they can't, then they dupe you into that giving up that money.
And you mentioned that they just ratchet up the pressure at every step of the transaction, where they talk about, there's a problem in transit and your puppy, you know, is stuck at an airport somewhere and you have to pay even more money to get it on its way. So they're very sophisticated at tugging at your heartstrings.
Right. They are very sophisticated, and they continue to do it until you run out of money or you finally realize it's a scam. And I think people are so excited, especially around the holiday season. The Better Business Bureau has issued many studies and investigations, and everybody is so excited. They just forget about any common sense, and it goes out the door because they believe they're getting this cute, adorable puppy for a price they can't beat.
I was hearing from another cybersecurity consultant a couple of weeks ago talking about extortion scams, and that usually the person who's trying to extort you via social media is located somewhere on the other side of the world. Is that the case in some of these pet scams as well?
Yes, they're on the other side of the world. You never know where they're truly at. The money keeps getting sent somewhere, and it gets picked up by somebody else. So when you send the money, it's like throwing the money outside the window. You're going to lose it. You'll never get it back. And especially if it's not done through a credit card, if it's done through a cash app, or if it's wired the money, it's gone. And unfortunately, they just keep stringing you along until you realize it. But we need consumers to let us know at the Better Business Bureau, our scam tracker, so we can prevent this from happening to others.
Steve Burness, president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau of Chicago. Thank you for joining us today to detail possible pet scams you may encounter during the holidays.